This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by the SANS Institute and hosted by SANS fellow Frank Kim. And now, prepare for departure. We're cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Frank Kim.
Hello and welcome to the SANS Cloud Ace podcast. I'm very excited to have on the show today, Nate Lee, who is the CISO at Tradeshift. Nate, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, hey, as we like to do, let's go ahead and start the show here with a little bit of personal history. So, Nate, can you tell us a little bit about your family, where you grew up, things like that?
Sure. So I'm originally from Minneapolis, so Midwest. Grew up there. My dad was a bus driver, and my mom kind of had started lots of her own businesses, so a non-tech family, let's say. But my parents had got me an Apple IIe when I was five, and I spent many nights stuffing kind of clothes under the crack of my door so they wouldn't see that I was kind of hacking away at stuff from a very young age. So really got my start in computers probably far earlier than your average person, and that kind of carried me through into diving into tech and eventually, of course, led out to Silicon Valley, the promised land.
Now, did you always know, I guess, because of that experience, that you did want to get into tech as a career or in school?
I don't know if I ever thought about it as like something for a career. It was just always so fun. I remember trying to write adventure games in BASIC as a kid. So like lots of go-to statements going back and forth, and I'm fairly certain that never worked well, but it was just super fun being able to kind of build with something, you know, you could take you away to another world.
Yeah, I remember all those go-to statements, lots of spaghetti code for sure.
Oh, God.
So then you're in school, and then, you know, you've got to find a job at some point. Now, did you start in security?
I didn't start in security. I started doing kind of more general system admin work, network engineering. I spent a lot of time doing, but with all of those, right? I mean, security is kind of part and parcel to doing any of those in any reasonably sensible way. So, I mean, I'd always been, I would say, security adjacent and very security aware. But really, I think over the last maybe 15 years is when I started focusing on that. I did a CISSP while I was working at Target because I was focusing on a lot of sort of security bits there on the network side. And then coming out to the Bay Area, working at software companies, I mean, it's you're exposing your services to the internet. You better be pretty security aware or problems will arise very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned being at Target. I believe, hey, when the breach occurred, that was a year or two after you had left.
After I left, that's I remember many discussions around some of the systems affected beforehand, but yeah, I wasn't there when the fan was hit.
Well, hey, lucky timing. So, you know, hey, you got to give me some, I don't know, stock advice or something, because it sounds like you got a little bit of a crystal ball there.
Well, I still had my stock at Target when that happened, so maybe you don't want the advice from me.
Hey, so you're in these various IT technology roles, and then, you know, how do you get into security full time?
I mean, I would say I sort of fell into it, but again, I think I was really already headed in that direction just based on a lot of the work I was already doing. When I started at Tradeshift, so the company I'm at now, we didn't have a security program. I was running the platform operations team, IT, site reliability, engineering, a few other teams. And then it really started to become a blocker for sales. And it's something that I was already fairly familiar with. And I think part of me wanting to jump into the role was because I'd worked in places where it was very GRC heavy, and people would put in controls that, you know, were what I would consider the wrong ones. And I really didn't want someone telling me what to do that wouldn't make sense. And I figured it would be better if I was in charge of that and, you know, could make sure things were done properly. So started from there, not necessarily a CISO, but really just building the security program. But then as the company grew and the role grew, started to focus more and more time before eventually just taking on the role full time.
I like that advice, that approach. Hey, you know, you don't want somebody else to tell you what to do. Tell yourself what to do.
I'm not sure I've heard anyone else with that story of how they got into it, but that really was it for me. I just had some fear of someone trying to make me rotate my password every 30 days, and it was too much.
Now, so you've been at Tradeshift, I think, a little bit, about 9 years now, right? So that's a long career, different roles, as you've said. Yeah, you said 10 years?
10 years. Next week, 10 years, yes.
Wow. All right. Congratulations. Yeah. And so, you know, can you tell us a little bit about the company, the business? You know, how did it change from when 10 years ago to today? And you know, along the way, you know, what did kind of technology it look like from a kind of, you know, cloud perspective? And how did that mature? Similarly, you know, what did security look like then versus now?
Sure. I mean, I think it's been really exciting. When I started, the platform itself maybe had 10 services, and that might even be high. It might have been something like 5. It was fairly monolithic as far as how the back end looks. So it's been really great being a part of that growth. So we've been kind of breaking off into microservices, moving into containerizing stuff, Kubernetes, you know, all of the cloud native stuff that we take for granted now. For companies that started 10, 15 years ago, you actually had to transition to that. You didn't get to build that way natively. So it was really great getting to work with the engineering teams on, you know, how do we think about where we slice this up? How do we talk about authorization, authentication between services? And you can't necessarily tackle all that up front. So really thinking through what can we do now? How do we make plans for the future to build this in a more secure manner? And just developing the engineering culture along the way. I mean, definitely had great relationships with the engineering team and support from leadership and the rest of the engineering org as far as building process and culture into how we build things. So over time, you know, moving to general microservices, we've always been AWS as far as 100% of the platform runs there. I think one of the interesting things was originally we were like, hey, we're going to do EC2 only because we want to be in control of our destiny. If we want to move to Azure someday or Google Cloud, you know, we want that freedom, which always seemed like a great idea. And then I think maybe like 5 years later, we're like, why are we doing this to ourselves? You know, we're managing so much operating systems and databases and this and that. So over the last several years, we've had kind of a market move to using more managed services, just to let us focus on delivery of, you know, the actual business differentiators, as opposed to we're really good at hardening our OS or something like that. So yeah, it's been a very interesting journey.
That makes a lot of sense. Anytime in the past, if I try to think back of where we tried to be technology or vendor or platform agnostic and try to architect the system in such a way where we could, at the drop of a hat, move from one platform to another, it never really worked out that way, right? From a practical perspective. So, yeah.
I mean, I think eventually, right, you would hit enough scale where like, okay, maybe it makes sense to have our own data center and you know, you move things on-prem as opposed to being in the cloud, but you really need to be at a fairly large scale before that starts making sense that you have network engineers and people racking servers and, you know, kind of managing all the physical bits.
Yeah. The how much of the security capabilities, you know, you mentioned working with all the other teams, you know, platform team, DevOps team, SRE, and so on. How much of it is kind of security building those capabilities with an engineering capability inside the security team versus, you know, working with those other teams, the other engineering teams, to have them build them into the product from scratch?
I think it's a mix, but it really ends up being that no security team is well staffed enough that you can build all of this, right? So working with the other teams to help educate them, I think, first on why it's important, because a lot of times to many of these teams, they know security is important. They want to build secure platform, but they don't necessarily understand how some of the vulnerabilities and threats could materialize in what they're building. So helping kind of educate them on, hey, here's how some of these systems may be exploited. Here's what the implication could be. And just really building relationships with them where they trust that you're also looking out for the best interest of the company and their team and the architecture and whatnot. Starting there is always great because then you can start having those deeper technical discussions and they'll bring you in when, if they're building out, you know, a new authentication layer or exposing some new services, they'll reach out ahead of time to say, hey, can you help me take a look at this? You know, is there anything you think we should be doing? Because if you start off from the standpoint of, you know, the ivory tower where you're just telling people you have to do this, here's your list of controls, and you're more of a kind of the police officer going around, people won't come and talk to you because they know they can get it almost out and then it's ready to release. And yeah, they'll tell you about it and you might not like it, but you're not really going to be able to do a lot. So I think for us, it was a lot of just making sure we work with teams, listening to their concerns. As an example, when we released static code analysis, so we started putting checks in place so that whenever developers were checking in code, it was looking for things like cross-site scripting, SQL injection, you know, all of the kind of OWASP bits. Making sure that we were super hyper reactive as far as any false positives or blocking, you know, starting in listening mode, tuning stuff if it's like, hey, this is alerting, but is this really an issue? Being really sensitive to that, I think that built a huge amount of trust that just paid off as we went forward as a security engineering program. So, I mean, with any of this, I think that's where I would start.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you mentioned a really good example of a tool, category of tool with SAST. And so was it really, hey, making sure that the SAST tool is running in the pipeline, in the CI/CD pipeline mm-hmm. itself? And as you said, just, hey, in non-blocking mode to start. And so you mm-hmm. actually get the findings repetitively. And I think we all know from experience that SAST solutions, you run them for the first time, gives you a gazillion findings. How did you, you know, work, get to the point of tuning down those rules to a manageable level so that the pipeline still actually runs decently fast?
I think we started with just turning down a lot of them that we knew would be kind of not terribly useful. And then we left it on blocking for, I believe, just critical, severe level, kind of major security issues. Not so much the, you know, hey, you use spaces, you should have used tabs. Didn't want to kind of wade into that mess. So we started from there and then, you know, we would start turning on more things. But again, just making sure that we were super able to react quickly if there was problems, because we have a fairly distributed engineering team. So across, there's folks in Asia, there's folks in Europe and in the United States. So being able to, if someone has problems, regardless of where they're at, you know, being able to kind of tune the alert, and if we can't, just disabling it for now and making sure we follow up quickly afterwards. I mean, that was very key.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other categories of tools that you found most useful as you're building the security program, especially related to cloud? Like how much did you use the cloud native, the cloud provider security related services mm-hmm. versus a third party off the shelf service tool?
I mean, and this is more reactive, but guard duty has been super helpful just when there are problems to kind of alert us. We've started using some CSPM, which is good in some ways, but I think a lot of them are just developing very quickly. And so we've had some usability problems and just general bugs we've been running into as we try to automate some of that usage. I think one of the other big things, and again, it's a bit more reactive, but you know, having a bug bounty program was really great. And I think obviously from being able to close some of the vulnerabilities you didn't find otherwise, but what it did is it made it real. Again, for developers, you're kind of like, hey, if this happens, and they're like, well, that's not an issue. And you're like, yeah, but if this happens and this happens together, and they're like, yeah, but could that really happen? And then you get a report where someone found it and actually did it. It makes it much more real. And again, that changes how people think about it because they don't want to write insecure code, but they also don't want to waste their time if they think that this is an impossibility. And then just the diversity of people who are hacking away at your system when you're in a bounty program is, I mean, it's just really something you're not going to get from, you know, a pen test from somebody if you have them come and have two people poking at your system for a few weeks. And I think that was really helpful, again, to set the culture of like, okay, these are things we need to worry about and really made people want to kind of shift left and get ahead of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned CSPM and, you know, that's kind of to me like becoming the vulnerability management scanning solution for mm-hmm. the cloud, you know, any misconfiguration, any issue. And a lot has changed in the last 5 years or so with that category of tool. But you mentioned some of the challenges. And what are some of the things that typically come up? Is it too many findings, deduplication, you know, not being able to track it to the root cause? What's been the most cumbersome things and how'd you get around those?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of a mix of all those. There's lots of findings. And I think this is something every security program has, right? You have a lot of findings. You turn on something that's going to find vulnerabilities in your software, especially if you start digging into dependencies and suddenly you're like, oh, if we turn this automation on, I'm going to throw 10,000 tickets at a team. Like, that's not helpful. So some of it was that, you know, figuring out from the findings, like, yeah, there's a vulnerability, but where does this fit in our list of priorities and actual risks? I think that's been still not something that we've been able to solve there. There's just been some general bugs as far as within the UI and APIs as we build out integrations and automation, where it's just been, I think, frustrating for the team a bit to try to sort out why something isn't working. And I mean, general things when you have a space that's been kind of come out of nowhere and built up so fast. So I don't necessarily fault the vendor, but it's been, I know, a bit frustrating for the team. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I still think it's as a tool class that will be super valuable, because as your company's cloud footprint grows, you can't kind of wrap your brain around all of it anymore. There's just different services. You have things deployed all over the place, different regions, and having something that can make sense of that and tie policies together across services. And, you know, is this exposed because it chains through, you know, whatever, the load balancer or something like that. I think there's still a ton of value there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of policies, you know, one of the ways that you build customer trust, get them to eventually buy your product, is by having third-party attestations, third-party mm-hmm. Reviews. And related to the policy, you know, it's got your SOC 1 type 2, your SOC 2 type 2, you've got your ISO 27000 and so on. And I think, you know, at TradeShift, you are the one that are responsible for getting all of those things in place, right? What was that journey like? How did you start with that? And how was it, where were the elements that were cloud related? Where was there a disconnect with kind of cloud, especially early on, in terms of mm-hmm. making the auditors feel comfortable that you were doing the right thing?
Yeah, and I think it's changed over time, because I think, like you said, if we look back 7-8 years ago when we were first starting, we had to do a lot of educating the auditor on what the systems meant, and figuring out how do we phrase controls in a way that makes sense for both our customers as well as the auditors, because, you know, people are like, where's your three-tier application? You know, do you have it? Where's your DMZ? And you have to kind of explain that we don't have a DMZ, but it's, you know, there's per instance firewalling, and then explain how security groups work versus, you know, host ACLs, things like that. So originally there was a lot of that. I would assume now with most auditors, they're going to be you know, fairly familiar with various cloud implementations. So it's probably less of an uphill climb there, but I think the big one with having these, right, is especially if you're a cloud provider and you're not, so, you know, a major household name, having these is just, you'd need to, because people don't know about your security program. And this is a way where you can describe the controls you have. You can describe how you think about security. I'm not sure how many people actually read my reports that we send to them. I'm always surprised when someone comes back with a question or has feedback. It's kind of gratifying to know that someone actually read it, instead of, I assume 90% of customers kind of get it. They check their box and move on with their day. But being able to describe the program for those customers that actually do care is super, super valuable. And being able to work with your auditors and guide them, because I think a lot of people take what the auditors say as, oh, hey, you need this, and then, you know, they'll put it in without really thinking about it. Being able to take feedback from the auditor and kind of synthesize that with what you know about security best practices and what you know about your systems, risks, threats, so forth, and being able to work with the auditor then to say, well, hey, maybe that doesn't make sense, but I think this is the concern you're talking about. What about if we change this control or add a control into something sensible? So I think that's one of the key things to really making sure you have a successful compliance program that adds value to customers and also doesn't alienate, you know, your engineers are going to be the ones especially sensitive to this, because if you're putting in controls kind of blindly because your auditor told you to, you're probably putting in some things that, you know, aren't adding so much value and, you know, are causing a big hit to productivity.
Yeah, yeah. Even though obtaining those third-party certifications might be kind of the headline, kind of mm-hmm. the magic is in how you actually get it done, not just blindly checking the box. Yeah, that makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. What did you start with? Did you start with SOC 2 Type 2? Did you start with ISO or PCI?
We started with SOC 1, oddly. We had that before I even started. I think it was a couple years old and hadn't been renewed. So we had that beforehand. And that really, for those that haven't gone through a SOC 1, it's focused much more on the financial controls, because our platform is handling supply chain finance, virtual credit cards, and all this. So it's what are the technical controls in your platform, both at the underlying infrastructure layer, but also at the application layer? What are those controls that ensure customers can have faith in how it could affect their financial reporting? And this has kind of been a challenge for my team, because as a security team, people just say, oh, SOC report here, you should work on this. But really, it's much more of something for the product team to own, as far as, what features do you have in place to make sure tax is calculated correctly, or that the invoice and the purchase order are reconciled correctly. So we started there, didn't have much to do with my team, but we ran it because it started with the letter S, and I think it had an audit and people just kind of threw it to us. And then we went with SOC 2 as our first security-related certification or attestation. And we did it, I wanted to go straight to a Type 2 because Type 1 is not necessarily super valuable. So we had kind of put things in place, did a quick gap assessment, and then I talked to our auditor about doing just a three-month SOC 2. So we looked at the previous 3 months, which is not super common unless you're doing quarterly. But we did that just so we could get something out in the hands of customers quickly. And then we moved to annual thereafter. And then this year, I think we just switched to doing biannual so we can kind of have it in a way that aligns with various customers' fiscal years.
Mm-hmm. And so then you went from the SOC 2 and then it was ISO. Was it easier to get 27001 because you already had SOC 2 Type 2 in place? You know, I've always, in the past, I've always felt like, hey, ISO 27000 is a little bit more rigorous, a little bit harder. So I've always started with SOC 2 Type 2.
Yeah. I mean, we did, it was fairly easy because we used the same auditor. So they'd already been gathering evidence for a lot of the stuff. They already were very familiar with the different controls we had in place, how the platform works, kind of the back office systems. So I think in a vacuum, it probably would have been more difficult to start with 27001, but because we already had kind of the familiarity with the auditors and they had familiarity with us, it made a much lighter lift, I would say.
How long did that take? How many months did that take to from beginning to end to get it?
For the 27001? I'm not even sure off the top. I had probably 6 months from when we said we were going to do it until we actually had them come. Because I think it was, we'd finished up 1 year's audit cycle, and then somewhere, in the middle, we realized we wanted to add this as well. So we added that on and started the prep work, and then they were able to come through and kind of do those additional checks when the audit time come. We ended up combining all of our audits, which saves a bit of cost, but also saves a bunch of time on our side because, like you said, we have, whatever it is, 4 or 5 of them. A lot of them are going to have kind of overlapping checks, right? Like, are you offboarding users correctly? Are you reviewing firewall rules, whatever it might be? So you can kind of kill all those at once across all of the reports. So that was fairly handy as well.
Yeah. So you're also involved in some customer-facing items, for example, mm-hmm. like negotiating customer contracts. Certainly it helps to say, hey, here's our third-party certification reports. What are some of the important points that come up in those customer negotiations?
I think the points that come up are just general things they want to make sure you're dealing with, vulnerability management, there's the standard bits of are you encrypting data and things like that. Generally, I think one of the important things when dealing with customers, hopefully you can get it on your own paper where your contract is kind of customized to your platform, but often when it's sort of it's not symmetric, right? Your customer sometimes can be multiples larger than you, and they have all the leverage in the world. Like, you want to close this deal, you're going to use our security addendum. And often in those times, it's really helpful to make sure you're having a conversation with them as you go through, not just crossing off all the things you don't want to do or won't do or can't do, because there's just a lot of things that show up in some of these contracts where they've been in there probably for the last decade or 2 decades. It doesn't make sense, including my dreaded, you will rotate all of your passwords every 60 days or something. And it really helps to sit down with those customers to understand what's the risk that they're actually looking to address with this. Because when you dive down into it, most of them are like, oh, this has just always been in our contract. I didn't really think too much about it. So being able to have that conversation in a non-confrontational manner, and being able to just listen to their concerns and then talk through how you've addressed it in other ways, and you know, be able to come up to with some mutually agreed language from that. I think that's probably the most important thing when it comes to going through those customer contracts, because otherwise it can be fairly easy to end up sort of in an adversarial position, or where you get frustrated because you're just, if it's kind of a larger, not software focused company, it can just seem like they don't understand what they're even asking for. Sometimes maybe they don't, but I look at the role kind of also as, you know, one where you're helping to educate them, which will help them, you know, at their jobs and going forward to assess risk for their other vendors as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you said, it's in terms of those requirements, you know, the contracts are typically custom. They mm-hmm. want it on their paper. A related element of that is, you know, all of the different customers usually have their own long, laborious security questionnaire that they want you to fill out. Have you found a decent way around that and having to fill out different questionnaires, numerous, you know, every single time?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the bane of anybody who ever is tasked with that job. You get the 300 question Excel spreadsheet, and you know, God forbid you get the one that someone's had too much time to add macros and kind of field validation or something to it. What we did originally, because the team was really small, we didn't have a lot of time to just be stuck doing a lot of these questionnaires. So we worked with our solutions architecture team, so like the pre-sales engineers, and helped them kind of populate an RFP database with all of the right kind of questions and answers, things like that. And then had them take the first stab at it so that it would be more distributed across the sales team. And then, you know, of course, happy to help address any concerns that weren't covered there. This year, though, one of the things we did, just as kind of a side project, I was hacking things together, had wrote a security white paper, which is something I put together, just so we would have, you know, something I that you know, the marketing team made pretty, but it kind of described our security program. Modeled it after the folks at Confluent had a really nice one, which I was jealous of. So kind of took some of that format and wrote it to cover our platform, but kind of plain English, right? Describing what you do and how you address various concerns. And then I realized that, hey, this covers a lot of the stuff that would be in a security questionnaire. So used just some Python libraries, created embeddings out of that, and turned it into a Slack bot that you could ask questions, and it would kind of query the document to find the relevant phrases, send that off to OpenAI. They would respond with an answer based on whatever I popped out of the that white paper as relevant, and then would provide the response as just a Slack message back to whoever was asking. So again, for our solutions architects, or maybe it's a salesperson or support, whoever, they could ask a question of the Slack bot and kind of get security answers back, which I think also helps on the questionnaire side. I mean, you could kind of harness that directly into spreadsheets as well and just have it be a function that gets called. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I assume in the nearish future, this is going to be a product someone makes, and, you know, having to fill out security questionnaires will be one of those old war stories people tell that young people won't understand.
Hey, that is very cool, which is a perfect segue to talk a little bit more about AI and Gen AI and large language models. You mentioned that embeddings, and you know, maybe in your case there was a vector database involved as well. And for our listeners who, you know, who are just starting to get familiar with all of this, can you kind of describe maybe the high-level LLM application architecture? What are the different components? Certainly, hey, anybody using ChatGPT knows that you've got to provide a prompt, and then, you know, on the back end, all of this magic will happen. But how is this functionality being integrated into, well, like the application you built or the applications that many other companies, SaaS providers, are building as well? What is that high-level application architecture?
Sure, sure. And I think, I mean, this is where it's really exciting because the architecture blueprint, I mean, there's some general high-level things out there. I think Andreessen Horowitz has a fairly nice LLM blueprint that they have out. But at a high level, you're taking user inputs, and whether that's a prompt or maybe it's a document you want summarized, or, you know, a question you're asking about a knowledge base, you're going to take that, and at least for the use case I just mentioned, you want to be able to provide the extra context, because those LLMs are trained on whatever's on the internet, but it's also fairly general. It's not going to know specific controls that I have within our program. And even if we had that public and it was in the training data, it's not something that would be repeated across the internet enough that it would probably be able to verbatim come back correctly. You'd end up with some hallucinations, and it would say things that we're probably not doing. So the way around that is the retrieval augmented generation. And so basically, like you said, we take some embeddings, which is, if we just take like a Word doc or something as an easy example, you run it through, in this case, I just use some simple Python libraries. It ingests the Google Doc, takes chunks in whatever size makes sense, and then converts that to vectors, which is the kind of numerical representation of whatever that data is. And so it's just a list of, however many, I think it's 2048 different numbers. And basically, when someone asks a question now, it's going to do the same thing with the question they asked, create these embeddings, create these vectors. And now it can just do a similarity thing. So it compares all of the numbers, sees how close they are, and they can say, okay, well, this is the chunk from the white paper that looks closest to what this person's asking. And then all it is, and this is where I think, when OpenAI released their GPTs, it probably killed, half of the new AI businesses, because this is all a lot of them were doing. You're taking the user's input, whatever their question is, you're taking the relevant context that you've snipped out of the documents you've processed into vectors, and then you're sending that to OpenAI with a system prompt that says, hey, you're a helpful security answering bot. Here's the user's question, and then you insert the question, and you're like, here's some relevant context, and then you insert your snippet out of your document you've created. You're like, give them a concise answer that's three sentences long, and then you send that off as an API call to OpenAI. They shoot something back, and that's your answer. I think there was a lot of companies that were built around basically doing that, and now it's just a kind of a very easy thing to set up within OpenAI.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That was a really good overview. And you mentioned kind of that newish feature that OpenAI recently announced called GPTs. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of the manual work, if you will, that you were doing to create the application and tie these API calls together and figure out what data should get sent, a good chunk of that now is, as you said, kind of mm-hmm. Made easier, right, by the GPT functionality that OpenAI has published.
Yep. Yeah, and it's super interesting just to, watching how fast they're releasing things and watching what this enables people to do with all the new tools. I mean, it's exciting times.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned kind of the example of a Google Doc or a Word doc and the security white paper that you had written, and that is input into, mm-hmm. the retrieval augmented generation. What other types of information did you feed it? Was there other configuration information, other specifics about certain tools and so on?
No, in this case, this was really just me hacking stuff together because I wanted to see how it worked. Obviously, you can do lots of different things, though, right? You could, in theory, you can tie it into whatever. It has the potential to understand different codes. You could, I assume, tie it into, your infrastructure as code repos if you wanted to be able to ask questions about how X, Y, and Z is set up. I don't know how well that would work. It would probably take a bit of tuning to figure out how to best route it and provide the right context, but it really can take in anything. And if you think about, like Google just had their new release of, maybe it's just soft release, but they have their Gemini model coming out now, multimodal from the start, so able to...
Supposedly better than GPT-4, right?
Supposed to be better than GPT-4, especially in code and answering complex questions and doing reasoning. And I mean, I think as these models get better and better, it opens up more and more doors. And as they're all competing, the foundational models will start becoming commoditized, which is great for everyone else. They're also, having different tiers. So you can have the ultimate super performance one where it can do crazy advanced logic and reasoning. It'll probably be more expensive, but then all the way down to models that are small enough to run on phones, laptop, whatever. And that's really just going to enable so much more as far as functionality, things you can do, the speed you can do it with, the security around it, because if you're running the model locally on your phone or computer, very different than sending it off to the cloud and having to trust somebody else with it. So yeah, lots of interesting things happening there.
Yeah, so you just now started to segue into the security consideration. So when you're fine-tuning a foundational model like you're talking mm-hmm. about through this process, what are the things that security teams and development teams should be thinking about as you're sharing some of this data with the foundational model provider?
I mean, I think a lot of it is really stepping through to understand how all these bits work, because like what I was doing was the retrieval augmented generation, right? So it's pulling specific data and sending that as part of the prompt. Versus fine tuning, which maybe it's giving it a bunch of examples of, you know, here's a question, here's how I want you to answer. And that's where you could, you know, train it to answer like a pirate or something like that, or, you know, in whatever tone you want it to, and less about feeding specific data back into the model. And I think it's really worth it for people that are, especially if you're going to be working on security sort of related projects for anything generative AI related, to make sure you understand, you know, how do the models work? What does fine tuning actually mean? What's the effect this is going to have, and what sort of threats and risks? What's the likelihood? Because there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of different things out there, right? And with LLMs, there's a lot of ways that you can break them that we haven't discovered yet. I mean, there was the, you know, type in whatever the word is and just repeat it for forever, and then it spits out training data. That happened last week. So I think really diving into, make sure you understand how these work. You don't have to be, you know, a data scientist, but really understand, like when we talk about fine tuning, what is that doing? And when we talk about using fine tuning to adjust the weights, like what does that actually mean? I think that's probably one of the most helpful things people can do. And it sounds intimidating because, you know, the people working on this are all PhDs with advanced math degrees. But you really can get a fairly solid understanding of how they work, at least to the point where you can understand, okay, what are the actual risks and how can we prioritize them in a sensible manner?
Yeah. So, you know, if we take a step back, there's kind of two buckets. There's kind of what's acceptable use for users using things like Microsoft Bing or ChatGPT, right? Are they potentially sending sensitive data in the prompts and so on, right? That's always a concern for potentially any system. But then what you're talking about right now is, hey, more deeply understanding what are the nuances, what are the differences between retrieval augmented generation, fine tuning, or maybe even train your organization training its own model from scratch with some proprietary data that may be in-house, which we haven't exactly covered. So security-wise, right, what would be the guidance in terms of kind of thinking about that? Is it associated with the risk level? Is it, you know, hey, there, you've got an engineering team that's building out this capability, you know? For all our listeners, what would you say, hey, what should the security team, what should the CISO be doing right now once they've kind of better understood what the organization is doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd again start with the just making sure you understand the workings, because I think for both sides, it's helpful, right? Even with how users are using, if they're pasting something into ChatGPT. I mean, I know there was a huge bunch of noise made around if somebody pasted in X and now it's in ChatGPT's training data and it'll pop back out, was kind of the fear. And I mean, is that really something that would happen? Probably not. But making sure you understand why or why not, because the more you raise kind of a false alert, you lose credibility, right? So it's making sure you understand the level of risk there. But when it comes to if your engineering teams are looking to build something, really, I think it gets to starting to think through how does authorization take place? Where is it taking place? What does the system architecture look like? Like we were saying, that the LLMs are going to be broken in ways that are going to be new and novel, and they'll probably be coming out on a weekly basis. So while you should have layered defenses, you know, you want to have protections against prompt engineering. So you put in, you know, there's different libraries that can protect there or external services. But you have to assume those will break as well. Like someone can trick the filter by having it reply in a different language or in parts of Base64 encoded or whatever kind of crazy thing people come up with. So I think it's something you want to make sure you're talking to them about. How can we, at a more fundamental level, protect the data? So you don't want the LLM making a decision on, should this person be able to see X, Y, or Z? Because the person might tell the LLM that, you know, it's critically important that they know, and someone will die if they don't, and the LLM will feel bad for them and give them the data. So it gets to, how can you segment the LLM separately so that the data is never accessible to the LLM unless that person has the rights to view it. And you want to be able to have a kind of that strong security story so you can answer customer concerns with a fundamental, like, this is not possible. These are the controls we have in place, and this is why.
makes a lot of sense. In terms of kind of tooling, have you seen any trends in terms of most popularly used tool chain to build these LLM-based applications? And similarly, on the security side, have you seen any tooling that is so far seems to be helpful?
I mean, LangChain is the one that, you know, most people are using, I think, to start taking inputs and outputs and tying them together. There's stuff with agents. So you have like AutoGPT, where people are making agents that can kind of do things. I think that that's still sort of problematic in its current iteration. Again, I think all of these will get better and better over time, and probably in the near to midterm. But right now, they can get easily stuck in different loops where, you know, things just sort of break and fall apart as you get kind of more and more complexity and need to have multi-step sort of actions. On the security side, I'm not totally aware of you know, any specific tools. I mean, I think it really would be using these general tools that are available. It's kind of thinking through, you know, what are the use cases that you can do. You can integrate it certainly into different tools to help maybe parse some of your data. But I think even without building anything, there's a ton of value in just using like ChatGPT, right? And coming through, if you're especially for smaller shops where you don't have dedicated teams, right? Like maybe you don't have an IR team, or it's a very small team. Being able to kind of say, hey, here's our situation. Here's what our systems look like. You know, can you give me a prioritized list of things I should be checking? Obviously, you want to still have, you know, contracts in place. So you're not sending all of this stuff off and whatever. But I think there's a ton of value in being able to use it as your sidekick or your assistant or co-pilot, whatever we're using these days. But to guide some of that, like, hey, you know, are there things that if I'm looking at lateral movement, like how would I know on whatever system maybe I'm not fully familiar with, how could I look for indications of compromise here or there? What other things should I be looking for? So I think doing like tabletop exercises where you can kind of have people get used to using some of these AI augmentation bits can be super helpful. And especially if you're kind of a smaller team where, you know, everybody's got 47 hats on, can be really, really helpful there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool. Now, hey, so before you built this in-house LLM application security answering bot, you know, you had to figure out how all this works and figured out how to you know, write the Python code. So how did you start? And by extension, where should people start when they're first learning about all of this?
Sure. I mean, I think especially on the security side, Caleb Sima wrote a really awesome post a couple months ago, super in-depth, but digestible, where he kind of documented his journey through learning about LLMs and taking on all of this. And I think that's as far as a primer, just to get you up to speed on how the things work, the different threats. That one's super helpful. He also had put in some of the resources he used to learn. And one of those was a fast AI course, which was kind of building, like using PyTorch to build your own model and train your own model. And it was super interesting and eye-opening for me because within a few hours, I'd built a classifier that could, you know, tell a cat from a dog or something. Like the libraries just do so much of the heavy lifting now. And it was, I mean, I guess it makes sense now that when I, you know, think about it, but I wasn't really aware of how easy and straightforward some of this was. And it also gave me a kind of a deeper understanding again of how things work, which when you're trying to secure it, right, it's very helpful to understand how the pieces fit together and what they do. You don't have to know exactly how stochastic gradient descent works, but like, knowing that something's there, it's kind of figuring out if a weight moves this way and it's good, then it keeps moving it. I mean, kind of just that high level understanding is super helpful for you to understand, you know, what the different threats that face this are and if the controls you're proposing are going to make sense and are going to be helpful or not. So yeah, when it comes to getting started, definitely that's helpful. And then even if you don't, you know, write a lot of code, it's getting to the point with GPT-4 that like it can help you quite a bit. And if you don't understand something, it's now you can ask it. And it's not like, you know, you're asking the senior developer at the office who's now going to think you're an idiot because you didn't know why this did that or whatever. You can ask it and ask it to explain it to you. You can ask it to explain it to you like a 12-year-old. You know, it's super helpful just to learn. So if you're not someone with a development background, it can be super helpful for people to just start getting that, right? Like start building some basic scripts that automate, you know, whatever easy problem you might have. And then just make sure you understand what it's doing. And if you don't know what it's doing, I mean, probably shouldn't use it, but you should be asking it to explain it so you now can understand and use that as a learning experience for yourself as well.
Very cool. That's why tech and security is so fun, because there's always something new to learn.
Very cool journey. This is just wild with how much there is to learn. I mean, I think in the last like 30 or 45 days, there's like 2,200 papers that have been released on LLMs. I mean, it's just like you can't possibly keep up. So it's been super fun to try, I guess, on that front.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, so before we close out the show, we're going to switch gears here and give you an opportunity. We'll move to the reverso round here, give you the chance to ask me anything that you might want to ask.
Yeah, I was curious. I was thinking about this. I'm like, what would be a very insightful question I could ask? I'm not sure I came up with one, but...
Well, I won't have an insightful answer, that's for sure.
Well, I was kind of wondering if you know, historically, because you've had a lot of experience, you know, both being a CISO and you know, talking with other organizations, but for you personally, has there been a time where, you know, you're running the program and there's a particular threat or control or something and you've invested in it and driven towards it. And then, you know, in hindsight, you're thinking, oh, maybe that wasn't as critical as I initially thought. So similar to what we're talking about, you know, on the AI side, right? Where I'm worried about some things. And then the more I read about it, they're like, oh, maybe I should rethink this. You know, is there an interesting story you have about a time where you've had that?
That's a very good question. And, you know, this is probably makes me think back to quite a number of years ago, a long time ago. And, you know, by nature of the fact that we're, in a CISO role, kind of building out the security program, we're inundated a lot of times with different vendors wanting to sell us stuff. And sure, there's probably been, you know, only in hindsight that once or twice, there's been a time where I've spent a moderate amount of money on some vendor solution. And I'm always careful to not buy something we don't need because then it becomes shelfware. But then it didn't really do what it said it was going to do, and or there was more overlap with other capabilities, other products that I thought I only realized in retrospect. And you were giving the example earlier about, you know, all of the third-party certifications and really what working with the auditor of, hey, what is the intent of this control or this thing that you're asking for, and can we solve it in a different way? And I think more so that that issue you're describing was more for me of implementing a new capability, buying a new solution that maybe it incrementally made us 10 or 20% mm-hmm. better, but was it really worth all of the effort and the time and not only the cost, but the people time to actually do it when, oh yeah, you know, hey, it's actually, you know, our other solutions, our other three solutions that we've got do this, you know, could have handled it if we approached it a little bit differently. And, you know, there's been studies or surveys that have been done and, you know, every large organization has dozens, scores, if not hundreds of different security tools. And that's always been one of the hardest things for me is to kind of rationalize and think about, hey, well, what tools are being used? Are the right features turned on? Do some products need to go away? Is something get superseded or not? Yeah, that's always been very difficult in terms of mapping that to the process and where there might be process gaps or inefficiencies in the program overall.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I think it gets to kind of the general challenge that we have in the CISO role, right? I mean, there's a million things you could be doing. They will all, like you said, incrementally move the security program to be a better place. And, you know, in a vacuum, they're all great ideas. But then it gets to, you know, is this the most important thing we can be doing? Is this where we should be spending our time? And it's such a hard question sometimes. I mean, I know I've been guilty, like, especially when we flipped on, like we were mentioning, doing scans and finding vulnerabilities, and you realize all the third party libraries that are out of date, and you know, thinking through what, like, hey, we need to fix all of this, and then eventually you're like, well, where in an attack chain would this be? Like, is attackers have budgets, they have, you know, time that they need to account for. Are they really going to be trying to find some obscure library here, you know, way down here, or are they going to try to fish someone and, you know, get their credentials? And should we be, you know, putting better preventative controls there? So, I mean, I think it's a problem that hits all of us.
And that's why, you know, things like MITRE ATT&CK are super helpful. I mean, before MITRE ATT&CK existed, I remember years ago, you know, we and the team creating an in-depth detailed spreadsheet of all of the threat actors and different things they can do and so on, and trying to do some elaborate calculations of, you know, where we might need to invest in certain controls. And to be honest, in retrospect, again, it's easy to say that that was way too over-engineered. You know, the basic, simple approach was directionally put us into the right direction for as much as doing that complicated spreadsheet did, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, because I actually still like that idea of like thinking through what are the things you're going to protect and then like, okay, what are the easiest ways to hit it? And then if they couldn't do that, what would they do next? And like to, as an exercise to help prioritize. But I mean, it's such a difficult challenge, especially at a larger org where you have, you know, super complex systems and then you have people and you have the corporate infrastructure. And it's there's a lot of different things that need to be balanced.
Yeah. Well, great, Nate, that brings us to the end of the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was great to chat.
All right. Appreciate it. Talk to you next time.
Bye.